suspect was arrested Sunday for allegedly breaching coronavirus restrictions after he held a series of sermons with tens of thousands of followers. Rizieq Syihab's arrest came just days after Jakarta police shot dead six followers of his hardline Islamist group in a highway shootout. Police said that the cleric will be detained for 20 days to prevent him from fleeing and destroying evidence, as well as repeating offenses. Syihab was welcomed by tens of thousands of followers at Jakarta Airport at his return from exile last month in violation of a COVID-19 ban on gatherings. Dozens who attended him later tested positive for COVID. Indonesia has reported more than 600,000 coronavirus infections and over 18,500 deaths, with authorities imposing nationwide restrictions to curb the spread of the disease. Despite those restrictions, the cleric held sermons and even his daughter's wedding, which were attended by thousands of people. The charismatic leader of the Islamic Defender Front, he fled to Saudi Arabia shortly after police named him a suspect in a pornography case in 2017, and he remained there in exile for 3 years. In the past, his movement has targeted nightclubs and other establishments it deems immoral, and has also attacked minority Muslim sects it considers deviant. London and Brussels agreed to go the extra mile in coming days to try to reach an elusive trade agreement, despite missing their latest deadline to avert a turbulent no-deal exit for Britain from the European Union at the end of the month. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the president of the EU's Executive Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, had given negotiators a Sunday deadline to find a way to resolve an impasse, but they have gone past that. This is VOA News. Sudan's Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok arrived in Ethiopia on Sunday with what a senior Sudanese government source said was an offer to mediate in the conflict in its northern Tigray region. Hamdok, who was accompanied by Sudanese security officials, also planned during his two-day visit to present his country's concerns about threats to its security along the border with Tigray, the source said. Tens of thousands of Indian farmers on Sunday intensified their protests against three new agricultural laws aimed at overhauling food grain procurement and pricing rules by allowing private companies direct access to the vast agrarian sector. Angry farmers staged demonstrations near New Delhi after rejecting Prime Minister Narendra Modi's assurances that the laws would double farmers' income. Iran has summoned the ambassador of Germany, current holder of the European Union's rotating presidency, over EU criticism of the execution of an Iranian journalist, Iranian media reported on Sunday. The Iranian foreign ministry also said it planned to summon the French envoy to Tehran, the semi-official Fars news agency said. France also strongly criticized the execution on Saturday of dissident journalist Rohala Zam, who had been based in Paris before he was captured and taken to Iran. Chinese authorities have detained a Chinese national working for the Bloomberg News Bureau in Beijing on suspicion of endangering national security, the news agency and China's foreign ministry said. According to a Bloomberg report, the journalist was seen being escorted from her apartment building by plainclothes security officials on Monday, shortly after she had been in contact with one of her editors. And Indonesian police say they have arrested a senior leader of the Al-Qaeda-linked JI network for an alleged role in the deadly 2002 bombings in Bali. A spokesman for the national police said he was arrested on Sumatra Island on Thursday after spending nearly 18 years at large, and that he is now being interrogated and anti-terror investigators were searching his residence. In Australia, with as much as 18.7 inches of rain in the previous 24 hours, the Bureau of Meteorology issued a severe weather warning for the border area between New South Wales and Queensland states, a heavily populated area that includes the Queensland capital of Brisbane. This latest comes just days after bushfires threatened an Australian World Heritage site. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. A major turning point in the battle against COVID as the UK rolls out the first Pfizer vaccine. And here in the US, as numbers continue to surge, President-elect Biden announces his team to take on the pandemic. Also, the Supreme Court deals a major blow to Republican efforts to overturn the election. President Trump, though, continues to falsely insist that he won. Welcome to the show, Richard, Ashraf. I'm excited to talk to you both. Let's talk about some good news that's finally coming out in this global fight against the coronavirus. This week, the UK became the first Western country to roll out a COVID-19 vaccine. Richard, who are the first people to get the vaccine in the UK? What do we know about the UK's plans on vaccinating everyone?
It's a very interesting experience because UK becomes the first country to face the challenge of this general universal vaccination, and the eyes of the Western world and the rest of the planet are on UK. First, they have like 800,000 doses available, with millions to be vaccinated by the end of the year. That's the target. And the decision has been to vaccinate people over 80 years old first, residents and workers of care homes, and a certain number of healthcare workers. So I just want to, because she's become a reference, Margaret Keenan, 21 years old next week, has been the first to receive the shot. And she was followed by 81-year-old William Shakespeare. You can't make that up.
I know, that's part of the story.
Literally. And what's important in this very case is that with over 61,000 deaths, the UK has been the worst hit in Europe. So it's even more important that we keep an eye on this experience with the vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech on that side.
Right, and we'll talk about sort of how that might play out here in the US, since the Pfizer vaccine is likely to be approved shortly by the FDA here in the US and will roll out sometime soon as well. But before we get to the US, Ashraf, we should say other countries, Russia and China specifically, they've already begun vaccinating people there. But there are questions about just how safe and effective those vaccines are and the type of rigorous trials they have gone through or not have gone through, compared to what Europeans or US regulators are demanding. This can get really tricky because, for instance, China is already selling their vaccine to other countries in the Middle East. Morocco, for instance, is buying China's vaccine. How is this playing out, given again that we don't know how safe and effective the Chinese vaccine is?
That was always going to be a dynamic with the kind of, to use the American terminology, the warp speed that has been put into this push. I mean, the fast turnaround, chances are some corners have been cut in some places to get to this place, because normally from zero to vaccine takes years on any new virus. So all of this is happening in a rushed environment. And so there's legitimate cause for concern in some cases of some countries moving too fast. In some populations, you're going to have automatic distrust of vaccines, which, if there's any problems with these first batches, if they prove to be ineffective, sometimes vaccines make people sick. If you get too much of that or too much media coverage of that, it's going to fuel skepticism of. So yeah, this is a dicey time where we are not at the finish line yet. Some things are in sight, but there's a lot of questions and a lot of obstacles, a lot of pitfalls.
It's a good point you bring up about the sort of murkiness around vaccines, even here in the US, where there are very rigorous human trials before the FDA is going to go ahead and approve the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, which are the two leading vaccines that are set to be approved. There's all this misinformation around vaccines and the fact that people do get side effects. And so people are hesitating to put themselves in line for a vaccine. But I want to look at the other side of this, which is just how amazing scientists have been. They have been working around the clock for months. You've got these two vaccines, as I mentioned, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, that have been proven very effective against the virus. And as you mentioned, Ashraf, vaccines usually take years to develop. This happened in months. I mean, that is something we can root for, right, Richard? The science, at least.
Absolutely. Within a year to be able to achieve that point, it's been very impressive. And there are different trials all over the place. And what's interesting in Europe and North America is that we're going through clinically tested and authorized vaccines. It's not just, you know, like attempts we're doing here and there. And the simple fact that in the U.S., there's been this emergency use authorization that was applied for or requested from Pfizer and Moderna brings us really to the to phase three of everything that we've been doing. In few words, it's gone so fast. And it's interesting because I'm looking at the way it takes a little longer to confirm, to authorize the vaccine in the U.S. But if I look at my country, Canada, on Wednesday approved the Pfizer vaccine after a two-month review of clinical trial data. There is already a lot of data that we can go through and can inspire confidence in the quality of the vaccine, besides the fact that the experts come up with 94.5 or 95% efficacy. When we go through the data, and I think we can trust our experts, even in, as Ashraf said, there is a will to go a little faster maybe than we would in normal times. The result, the outcome is interesting. So in the U.S., pretty quickly, I believe, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, after consultations, are recommending that healthcare workers at risk of contracting COVID, residents of nursing homes, long-term care facilities, will be vaccinated first. So we can see a dramatic change of the picture of this tragedy within a few weeks.
Yeah, and I want to go back to what you just brought up, how it might play out here in the U.S. So, Ashraf, give us a sense, once the Pfizer vaccine is approved and then the Moderna vaccine is also expected to be approved, who will get it first here in the U.S.? What's the next group of people that will get it? Tell us how that's going to work here in the U.S.
Well, it's going to break down along the same basic parameters that Richard mentioned, the elderly and the most vulnerable and frontline healthcare workers. And that's one thing that I think needs to be sort of clear to everybody is that for normal folks, you and me, we might not be seeing our vaccine dose until April, May, something like that. What we're seeing in the first wave is people are already talking about shortages. You know, I cover the DC government, and they are already saying that the first allotment that they have been indicated from the CDC into first vaccine doses won't even cover 1/10 of the healthcare workers in the District of Columbia. So they're already sort of making noise saying we need more. And you're going to see that play out all across America and the country and the world. You're seeing warnings from the UN about countries competing for vaccines or hoarding vaccines, what the UN Secretary General called vaccine nationalism, I think is the phrase he used. So we're going to get the elderly and healthcare workers first. And then my prediction is in America and probably in Europe, what you're going to get is a whole wave of like celebrities and sports leagues getting their vaccines so that the games can go on and then people complaining about that.
That's an interesting point about, let's say, celebrities getting it first, because it always seems that rich people get ahead of the line. But it also could send a message to people who are, you know, who are fans of these celebrities that the vaccine is okay to take. We know former presidents Obama and Clinton and George W. Bush have said that they would get it in public to sort of reassure people. So that could also be to the benefit, maybe, of reassuring the public these vaccines are okay. But to Ashraf's point, Richard, on this global competition for getting vaccines, I mean, there's reporting now that the Trump administration passed on securing additional Pfizer vaccines, although the administration is pushing back that when they passed on that, which was in the summer, they didn't know that the Pfizer vaccine would be so effective. They were throwing money at other vaccines at the same time. But it does add to this sort of really difficult conversation about who gets what when there just isn't enough at this point.
Yes, that's correct. And we saw with the Trump administration this week, the president himself signed this executive order, which was not explained clearly, was not expected either last week, even at the beginning of the week. Executive order prioritize Americans in the vaccination process for the vaccine developed in the U.S., which is actually very interesting. There is a mixture of a patriotic calls saying to the Americans, we are taking care of you. Look, we are forcing the companies, the mass pharmaceutical companies, to give you the vaccine first. But also there's obviously a way to try to avoid acknowledging that getting organized was not exactly the best way we can describe that the attitude or the way the administration worked during the summer, which brings me to the fact that there's always this problem with a certain number of people in the Western world, but in the United States, challenging vaccine, going for it. And I was following during last month, people from 30-40% saying, no, I'm not going to go for it. And Gallup last week did a poll, and 63% of the Americans are now saying they are going to go for the vaccine, for the jab, as the British say.
The poll numbers show that more Americans, still not enough for herd immunity, but certainly the numbers seem to be going up on how
yes.
many want the vaccine. And to your point, the Trump administration has gotten a lot of criticism over how they handle their coronavirus response. Although in the case of the vaccines, they're also getting praised for how much money they've thrown at the issue, Operation Warp Speed, as it's called. But I want to look at one other aspect of this virus, aside from the vaccines, aside from the people, so many people dying, so many people sick and afraid. Of course, there's the economic fallout. And Ashraf, Congress has been at loggerheads for months. They have not passed a relief bill. There does seem to be movement now, some positive movement. A bipartisan group has offered their solution. What's different this time about this bipartisan approach? Is it likely that we'll see a relief bill passed before the new year?
I do think it's more likely now. You know, they appear to be exchanging offers on each side. Probably the supporters of President Trump will say, oh, now that he's lost the election, even though they can't say he's lost the election, you know, now that he's lost the election, now Nancy Pelosi is willing to make a deal. She wouldn't have given the Republicans this kind of a victory. I'm not sure if that's what's in play. There is one absolute reality in that all of these congressmen have to go back to their home districts over Christmas and New Year's. And if they come home empty-handed, that's not going to play well. These folks have town hall meetings, and this is the kind of hyper-local thing that really can influence American politics on a national level. I bet you a lot of Congress people are thinking of having to face their constituents empty-handed over Christmas and New Year's if they don't come back with some money.
That is such a good point. All politics is local, and you certainly have moderate Republicans who have been pressuring Republican leadership that they've got to do something. Let's take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about President-elect Biden's team that he selected to tackle COVID-19 and some of his other cabinet picks and the response those picks are getting. So we'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro Reporter for the Associated Press, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. We are getting a much better idea of what President-elect Biden's cabinet will look like when he gets to the White House. This week, we learned that Biden has chosen retired General Lloyd Austin to lead the Department of Defense. Austin has a long resume, 4 decades of service, including being the top commander in Iraq and the head of CENTCOM, which basically means overseeing all military operations in the Middle East and Afghanistan. If confirmed, Austin will be the first African-American Secretary of Defense. Richard, why Austin? There were a couple of other really well-qualified names floated out there. So why did Biden go with this particular general?
I think it was interesting to see how Michel Flournoy, that we've been following closely, has went down in the scale of people ready for this position. I think Joe Biden, it's pretty obvious, is under extreme, and we hear it a lot of pressure from progressive, from civil groups, from groups representing minorities to have a very diverse cabinet, a diverse administration. And Lloyd Austin, being the first African-American to lead the Pentagon, would send such a signal. As Joe Biden himself said, with 40% of the troops being of minorities, or it's important that the leadership is a picture of this. In this case, however, it's very interesting to see, because he just retired 4 years ago in 2016. We went through the process with James Mattis of a waiver from Congress to put a military in position at the Pentagon, while there's this law that says the Secretary of Defense, if a former military, must have been out for at least 7 years. We want a civilian control of the military. So Lloyd Austin is a fascinating character, very respected military. The troops are going to support him. African-American sends a signal. But then Joe Biden, by doing this, forces his own Democrats in Congress to go against exactly the principles they've been challenging with the Trump administration.
It is so interesting because it's this puzzle, right? Like you mentioned, Biden has to please progressives. He has to come through on his promise for a diverse cabinet, but he also has to choose people that don't just check the diversity boxes. They have to be really well qualified. And Austin, as you mentioned, has this very long resume, has a lot of support from former military, but he's also a tricky pick because, again, he is only 4 years retired from the military, and that requires, Richard, as you said, a special congressional waiver. The thing is, Ashraf, when James Mattis, who was the last former military person that had to get this congressional waiver, when he was nominated, 17 Democratic senators voted against him because of this very issue of the congressional waiver. So where does that put Democrats now when they have to vote on Biden's pick in the Senate?
It's a headache for them. I mean, it exposes them to charges of hypocrisy. They're going to want to go along with the pick. It's one of those things with Austin, nobody's objecting to his qualifications. And since we've already set the precedent with Mattis, but yeah, they voted against. And so they're going to want to vote for this. And they'll be able to explain it away, but it's an uncomfortable situation that they'd rather not have. And as you said, there's kind of there's a mix and match element to these cabinet preparations, especially when you're going for diversity on a public level. So it gets almost a little cynical where you're like, okay, well, we can't have Michelle Portnoy because we've already had too many white people in the audience. Yes, she's a woman, but she's white. And so we need a black face, we need a brown, et cetera. So you get into just the visual and the racial and the gender issues of it. And then you get into complications like how long he's been out of the military, which 4 years isn't a very long time if you're concerned about civilian control of the military. And then you get into their actual policies. One of Biden's probably most controversial picks is for the Office of Management and Budget, essentially the budget control office of the White House.
That person really tries to push through the White House agenda in many, many, many different federal agencies. It's a very important sort of position that's going on in the background.
Exactly. And they've chosen a diverse choice, a qualified choice. She's got the background. Her name is Neera Tanden. She's Indian American. She has a compelling personal story and experience. But her politics, the Bernie Sanders camp, the progressive wing, almost hates her. Now they're objecting not on diversity issues or anything like that, but they're just like, oh my God, what this woman actually believes is not what we want. So the complexity, and they're interconnected. You choose one for this, then you can't choose one for this. And it's a real mindfuck field. But yes, this puts Senate Democrats in the awkward position of having to put themselves up to charges of hypocrisy. And it's probably going to happen, and they'll get through it.
I mean, politicians being charged with hypocrisy, what's new here? I think you're right that somehow they'll manage to justify whatever they end up voting. But if we look at the Senate, Richard, it is likely, based on what happens in Georgia, but it is very likely, where there's a Senate runoff right now, it is very likely Republicans will lead the Senate. Or if the Democrats gain control, it's going to be a very tight, narrow margin. So he also has to choose people that Republicans will vote for. He can't just choose people that Democrats will vote for. And so he has to choose people that are moderate. And for instance, the person that Biden chose to be the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, is a governor from an agricultural state. He's known as a moderate. But again, progressives are upset because he's not as progressive as they want him to be. It's really hard to please everybody, isn't it? I mean, how does Biden sort of make these selections without annoying somebody somewhere?
But Joe Biden is the victim of the campaign he drove to the White House. His campaign wanted to build this idea of a very diverse support for something new in the White House, not only white men, but something more complicated and more diverse, and it is important. But indeed, the voters didn't follow the Democrats in Congress. Even their control of the House is very, very limited. So it's going to be tough to win the Senate. I mean, the two wins in Georgia will be really, really tough. So he is really caught in a situation where there's going to be a lot of unhappy people. And the question is, who is he ready to displease? I was reading yesterday again, Bernie Sanders putting a lot of pressure on seats for progressives and important seats he's asking in the cabinet, not just faces. Like, for instance, Marcia Fudge, a very respected congresswoman from Ohio, would go to the Housing and Urban Development Secretary Department, which is not what was expected. You're talking about Tom Vilsack as Agriculture Secretary. The guy is really not the face of what the Biden campaign was putting forward. But Vilsack would be the kind of man that would please votes from the Republican in Senate. So we're caught in a situation where you will have to displease people. Who are the least dangerous people in all this group? I'm afraid the progressive are going to be the victims of his choice. This said, if you allow me, Shana, I think that when you look at the moment at what preoccupies the Americans most is fighting COVID. And you see this will to let science drive the fight this time. And his team of experts and doctors sent a very clear signal on this level.
Right. I'll mention he chose Rochelle Walensky, who's a very good doctor. She's the head of infectious diseases at a prominent Massachusetts hospital. She's going to be heading the CDC, which has really been seen as being sidelined under the Trump administration. But to your point, Richard, to Richard's point about Biden promising to put science ahead of politics, Ashraf, if we look at Biden's selection to head the Health and Human Services, who will be the cabinet pick to craft the COVID sort of strategy, Javier Becerra is not a doctor. He's not a scientist. He's an attorney general from California, and that has some doctors and scientists scratching their heads. Why did you not choose a doctor in that position?
Well, I think what Biden will counter with is he doesn't need a doctor in that. He needs an administrator, and he's got personal experience to back that up, in that his chief of staff, Ron Klain, was head of the Ebola task force under Obama with zero medical experience, but he is a practiced administrator. And he is generally regarded as having succeeded at that, at just sort of like getting all sides on the same page, preventing animosities, preventing miscommunications, and letting the science run things. So he has precedent for that you don't necessarily need a doctor. You need somebody who listens to the doctors and can administrate what is essentially a bureaucratic position.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And also, Becerra, as Attorney General of California, has really been leading the fight to save Obamacare. He's been heading lawsuits against the Trump administration's attempts to dismantle Obamacare. So I think it's really being seen as this selection is Biden sending out the message that he's all in with Obamacare, and that's why he chose Becerra as well. We have a couple of minutes left. I want to turn to our last topic. It's been a month since the presidential election here in the U.S., and President Trump is still falsely insisting that he won. This week, though, the Supreme Court dealt a major blow to Republican efforts to overturn the election. Richard, this is interesting because this is a conservative-led Supreme Court, three judges appointed by Trump. There was a lot of talk that because of Trump's picks, the election disputes that were certain to come up would go his way. But that's not what appears to be happening, is it?
That's correct. What's interesting is that the Trump campaign has really gone from failure to failure with election representatives, but also judges at different levels in their attempt to stop the count or throw out mail-in votes or overthrow the results of the election in battleground states. And the Republicans in Pennsylvania were asking that 2.5 million mail-in ballots be thrown out. And in one sentence, the justice simply said, no, we're not going to get there. And it's over without any dissent. And you could see it in the tweets by extension of the president, where it was asking courage from the justice and hashtag overthrow. But this is not going anywhere else if at the Supreme Court they say no.
I will say there is another suit that's being brought by, I think it's the Attorney
Texas,
General of Texas.
Yes.
Yeah. But given what the Supreme Court did here in Pennsylvania, legal experts don't believe that the Supreme Court will really pay much attention to this lawsuit. But the president continues to fight, and he continues to insist he won. Again, no evidence of that. All 50 states have now certified the results of the election. What's really going to be interesting is to see when Republican leadership in Congress, who have not come out and supported Biden's win, or at least even admitted that he won, when they will sort of change and confront with really reality here. We will be watching that. I'm sure you two will be as well. That is the end of our show. Thanks to Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, and Richard Lifton-Dress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, hate crimes in America. The FBI says that 2019 was the deadliest year on record. Our guest, Becky Monroe, Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. According to its website, the Leadership Conference is the nation's oldest, largest, and most diverse civil and human rights coalition committed to the protection and advancement of civil and human rights for every person in the United States. Since its inception in 1950, the Leadership Conference has lobbied for and won the passage of the Civil Rights Acts of 1957, 1960, and 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. It also helped to organize the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in August 1963, which was a defining event for the civil rights movement in the 20th century. On this edition of the program, we will talk with Becky Monroe about the findings in the 2019 FBI hate crimes report, which shows a 113% increase in hate crime murders since 2018. There were more than 7,300 hate crimes reported in 2019. According to the Leadership Conference, the number of law enforcement agencies voluntarily reporting their figures has decreased, which means the 2019 report only captures a fraction of the actual incidences of hate crimes. Race-based crimes comprise the largest number of incidences. As in previous years, anti-Black crimes were the highest percentage of violent hate crime incidences, accounting for nearly 50% of reported offenses. There was a 14% increase in anti-Semitic hate crime, and anti-Latino crimes increased for the fourth straight year in a row. Prior to joining the Leadership Conference, Becky Monroe worked at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She also worked within the Obama administration, where she served as the Director for Policy and Planning and Senior Counselor to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. And we're delighted to welcome Becky Monroe to tell us more about the factors behind the number of hate crimes in America and what practical steps can be taken to combat this trend. And Becky Monroe joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thank you, Becky. Please give us a bit more background into the current mission of the Leadership Conference. How has it adapted to today's challenges?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, the Leadership Conference, it is a coalition, and we're charged by our diverse membership of more than 220 national organizations to promote and protect the civil and human rights of all people in the United States. So as a coalition, we have this strength in our diversity and strength in the membership organizations that have really responded to this moment that you're describing now in terms of the increase in hate incidents and hate crimes in a way that is consistent with our history of leading by respecting the sort of community-centered approach to addressing hate. So what I mean by that is, you know, as we see these alarming numbers, and you talked about the fact that the FBI, based on its data, has noted that this is the deadliest year on record for hate crimes, we also know that hate is not new. The organizations that we are proud to represent as a part of this coalition have been fighting racism, fighting other forms of discrimination for generations. And so part of what we have done is, as we've seen this increase in the sense of, really the sense of emboldenment among groups that are promoting hate, is to call on the expertise and experience of people who have been confronting and combating racism and other forms of discrimination for many years. So at the Fighting Hate and Bias Project, which I lead here at the Leadership Conference, we are working specifically on addressing this increase in hate with a respect for the fact that the hate is not new, but that people are feeling newly emboldened to commit acts of hate. And one of the things we're doing to do that is to recognize the ways in which people who are targeted for hate are often targeted at the intersection of different forms of their identity. So one campaign that we're very proud of that we've been working on is called Black Justice is Our Justice. Part of the idea of this campaign is trying to really recognize there's a unique history within the United States, and it's a history that is must be reckoned with if we are to address both anti-Blackness, but also other forms of racism and other forms of discrimination in this country. So we talk about the fact that in order to fight anti-Semitism, we have to fight anti-Blackness. In order to fight anti-Asian American hatred, we have to fight anti-Blackness. And that's in part due to the unique sort of way that our country was founded. It was founded both with the genocide of Native Americans, but also on slavery. And so thinking about sort of how we as a coalition really are working together to make sure that the United States is a country that can live up to its ideals, that is as good as the promise of its ideals. So that's some of the way that we've been trying to think about this moment, but really respect the historical context that brought us here.
Well, thank you for that, Becky. And I think it's important to mention this intersection of religion, race, and ethnicity. And certainly, as far as anti-Semitism in this country, Jews are not a part of what we would call the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group, which has been, at least until recently, the majority culture in America. So if I understand it, a hate crime is a crime that manifests evidence of prejudice based on race, religion, sexual orientation, or ethnicity. So with that, let's go to the 2019 FBI hate crimes report. What is your biggest takeaway from that? Why has it been described as the deadliest on record?
The reason is it is described as the deadliest on record is that the number of murders that are connected to hate crimes almost doubled. That is the highest number since data has been captured. It is important to note that 2019 was also the year of the El Paso massacre, when a white nationalist specifically targeted the Latino community and murdered Latinos in El Paso, and that the number of people who were murdered in that one incident is part of why it was the deadliest year. 2019 was also a deadly year for many other communities. You noted anti-Semitism continues to be, actually this year it increased and it continues to be on the increase. Some of the murders were also included in anti-Semitic hate crimes. So the reason it is called the deadliest year is that in fact, it is the highest number of hate crime murders that we have seen on record since hate crimes data was captured. One note I want to make, and I think it's important to note at the beginning when we're talking about this data, is that the data in and of itself we know is underreported. And I'm happy to kind of talk a little bit about why we know that's underreported. But I think it's important to note that understanding that the data is underreported, we are still seeing 2019 as the deadliest year. The other thing I think that bears mentioning here is that we're talking about the 2019 data that just came out a couple weeks ago. This is not unique to this administration. Historically, it takes about a year and a half for the data to come out. So we're talking about 2019 data in November of 2020. We will talk about 2020 data in November of next year. And I think the reason I note that is that data drives policy. Data drives resources. Data helps us understand where we should be investing both in responding to hate incidents and hate crimes, but also in helping communities prepare and potentially prevent hate crimes. So I think that's something that's important to note as well. And finally, I think if we're looking at what's notable here, it's not only the devastating increases in hate overall number of hate crimes, the devastating number of people who were murdered in a hate crime, but I think it's also the fact that the number of law enforcement agencies that reported hate crimes in the United States decreased. So again, we're seeing an increase in hate crimes overall, an increase in deadly hate crimes at the same time that we're seeing fewer police departments participate in this data collection. That is a problem. The data collection is voluntary, and when law enforcement agencies do not report or affirmatively report zero hate crimes occurring, that not only doesn't provide the accurate information that law enforcement would need to effectively address the problem, it also sends a very clear message to communities that are targeted for hate that this may not be a priority for the people who, in theory, are charged to protect them.
Becky, I want to pick up on this point about the voluntary nature of the submission of data. As you said, and as has been reported, the data is underreported in 2019. So the fact that hate crimes are on the rise is very disturbing, because it could even be worse if we had more reporting. Why is the submission of data by law enforcement agencies voluntary and not mandatory?
The reason that law enforcement agencies report, it's connected to legislation in the United States, the Hate Crime Statistics Act. Now, the Hate Crime Statistics Act makes it mandatory for the FBI to attempt to collect the data, but it is voluntary for agencies to report. The question you're asking is a question that we are hearing from many advocates and other communities across the country, because again, we know this data is underreported. One way we know the data is underreported is that the FBI collects this data voluntarily from agencies. One data point is that 86% of law enforcement agencies in this country, and there are about 18,000 law enforcement agencies across the United States, 86% affirmatively report that zero hate crimes occurred in their jurisdiction. Historically, this has included states like the state of Alabama. It has included large cities. We know that statistically, this is not possible, that there are in fact zero hate crimes in many of these states and these cities. You know, the fact that one, that it's voluntary to participate, but the people are affirmatively reporting zero is a problem. The second point I think it's important to note is that the same Department of Justice that reports this data, so again, the FBI is a part of the Department of Justice in the United States, the same DOJ has another component called the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and that department has conducted what they call the National Crime Victimization Survey, NCVS. So the NCVS data is data that is actually based on a sampling system of surveys. So the same Department of Justice that says, yeah, the data is about 7,000, around a little bit more than 7,000 hate crimes in a year, that same department says, actually, using the NCVS sampling methodology, it's closer to 250,000 on average. That difference speaks volumes. The difference between around 7,000 and 250,000 is not just number of people who've been targeted, but it's entire communities. Because I think one of the unique things about hate incidents and hate crimes is that while they may appear to be targeting an individual or one person, they are really targeting a community. For example, in the hate crime in El Paso, he was targeting Latino shoppers at the store. He was really targeting Latinos across the country, and indeed across the world in many ways. When we look at other incidents of hate crimes and look at the data around sort of who's impacted and people who are directly affected, part of what is devastating about hate crime is it really is intended to be a message crime. It's intended to target others. So when you have this data disparity, again, it not only sends messages to communities about who counts, what kind of crimes matter, but it also makes it really difficult for law enforcement and for social service providers to know where to focus their resources. We cannot address a problem, just in the same way we can't address an epidemic, without having the data. So, you know, for that reason, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about what groups are trying to do to address this data gap, but that's why it's voluntary. That's why we know that it's underreported. And that's why there are so many advocates, hate crimes survivors, family members of hate crime victims that are really focused on this data piece. Because I know at first blush, people think, why are you talking about data and numbers? We're talking about people and lives. The reason is that these numbers translate into actions in terms of what our government can do and in terms of what our communities can do to support people targeted for hate.
Can we do something? Can we force law enforcement agencies to do a better job of reporting? Or is it that they have problem identifying a hate crime from a different crime? Would that make a difference if there's some sort of legislation that would require all law enforcement agencies, not just 12% of them or however many actually reported, to actually report these crimes?
There are a couple of different things that could help. And I think one effort that I want to highlight is, it's called the Jabara Hire No Hate Act. and it is named after two people who were murdered in hate crimes, but whose deaths were not recorded as hate crimes in the FBI data. It's named after Khalid Jabara, who was a young Arab American man who was murdered on the front steps of his own home by a white supremacist neighbor, whose actions and whose bias towards him and his family had been noted by law enforcement. And yet he was murdered, and it was prosecuted as a hate crime. It was in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is my home city. It was not reported as a hate crime in the FBI hate crimes data. The other person it's named after is Heather Heyer. And Heather was a young woman who was protesting racial injustice in Charlottesville and who was run over by a white supremacist. And again, her murder was also charged as a hate crime, but that data was not reported as a hate crime. So I think the idea is that the legislation there would provide very strong incentives for law enforcement to report. It would also make it easier for people who are involved in the prosecution of hate crimes to identify other ways of addressing hate incidents and hate crimes. So in addition to prosecution, in addition to using the hate crime statutes that we have available, thinking further about sort of more community-based practices and restorative practices. So that's one option. I think that it is certainly possible for the U.S. Congress to pass a law that makes it mandatory, and that would make it so that law enforcement agencies had to report that data. Finally, I will say I am a member of the Civil Rights Subcommittee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and I have worked with law enforcement leaders across the country who recognize the ways in which hate crimes devastate their communities, who recognize that they have a higher obligation to address those issues, and who are looking for ways to improve their response to hate incidents and hate crimes. And so I think there are departments that have recognized this. We have worked with law enforcement agencies across the country to train both to identify hate crimes as well as the importance of reporting them. So I think when we talk about the reason for the low numbers, I think it's important to both think about, as you noted, do law enforcement agencies recognize hate crimes when they see them so that they can report them effectively? And then do they actually, in fact, report them? But I think the other issue that perhaps we can discuss a little bit later is understanding that many communities who are targeted for hate, if law enforcement is not called, they may not feel safe to call law enforcement. So another reason that we have underreporting is that people don't feel safe reporting to law enforcement. And I think that's for many ongoing and historic reasons.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Becky Monroe, Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. That's the nation's oldest civil rights coalition dedicated to the advancement of civil and human rights for every person in the United States. We're discussing the findings in the 2019 FBI hate crimes report. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to one of our loyal listeners, Cra Emanuel, who resides in San Nicola Arcella, Italy. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Also, please tune in Saturday and Sunday to our sister program, Encounter. I'll talk with two Latin American experts about the deteriorating political and economic conditions in the once prosperous oil-rich country of Venezuela. The Maduro regime conducted elections for the National Assembly, which were boycotted by the opposition and widely viewed as illegitimate by the majority of Latin American countries, the United States, and Europe. That's the Latin American edition of Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. And now back to our special guest, Becky Monroe, Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Crimes Programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Let's turn now to the factors that are behind this ugly trend in the rise in hate crimes. You know, generally speaking, we're seeing here in this country hyper-partisanship, extreme polarization. I think the pandemic has exacerbated this. Socioeconomic inequality is on the rise. Tribalism, I guess, is a good word for what we're experiencing. But other analysts also point to an embrace of incitement or the demonization of the other. We're seeing that, you know, in anti-immigrant rhetoric. even elements of current political leadership, people using code words like globalists, describing George Soros as some boogeyman. He's a Jewish philanthropist and financier. But let me get you to help us understand what's going on and to what extent we're seeing more and more white nationalist groups and white supremacist groups perhaps feeling emboldened.
I think you've identified many of the factors. I think one thing, and I said this at the beginning and it warrants repeating, we know that hate is not new, but we also do know that due to political leadership, people do feel newly emboldened to act on hate. And so while white supremacy and white nationalism is not new in this country, it has been here since our founding, we know that with the encouragement of leaders at the top of a country and the demonization of people who are targeted for hate has in fact emboldened people to act, to commit more acts of hate. I think if you look at the data, even for 2019, as problematic as it is and as underreported as it is, the increase in hate crimes targeting the Latino community, that is a clear sign. I think when we look to 2020 data next year, I think that if the data is somewhat accurate, we will see an increase in hate incidents and hate crimes targeting Asian Americans. And that is connected in some parts to the pandemic because of fear mongering by political leaders purporting to blame Asian Americans for this disease and resulting in the targeting of Asian Americans for hate crimes. So I think there's no question that while it is not new, there is a new sense of emboldenment. And I think it's also important to note that the pandemic, in many ways, for people who had the privilege to not acknowledge or to address, whether it was racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim bias, anti-LGBT hatred, this pandemic has removed any opportunity to say that we didn't know. When you look at the numbers of people who are dying in this country, in the United States right now, the disproportionate number of Black and Brown communities that are suffering is directly connected to racism. It's directly connected to who gets resources and who gets support and how that sort of racism has been institutionalized. And you cannot help but look at that when you're trying to understand acts of hate and hate violence. That kind of climate that is created and that is emboldened by people fear-mongering is really critical to understand. You know, at the leadership conference, that's part of why we, when we started the Black Justice is Our Justice campaign, recognizing again that Black justice really is all of our justice, that if we cannot address anti-Blackness, we cannot address other forms of hatred. We worked with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, or BAJI, and part of it was just talking to them about the experience of confronting both anti-Blackness and anti-immigrant hatred at a time when both are being ratcheted up. And so part of our goal with that was both to highlight that reality and to let people understand the devastating impacts that racism and the anti-immigrant discrimination can have, and to make sure that we were, that communities, that they were being recognized not only because they had to confront that kind of hatred and racism, but also to be recognized for their strength and the beauty and the joy in families that have come to this country, sometimes seeking opportunity for their families and for their children and the contributions that they make to this country, and also sort of heralding that and celebrating that.
We are supposed to be and are a country of immigrants. So we need to, you know, look at that component of our makeup. Becky Monroe, I wonder if you could address the role of social media platforms, to what extent they just amplify some of this rhetoric, the hate and discrimination that we're seeing, unfortunately, increasing in this country.
There's no question that social media platforms both have the potential and indeed have actually increased hate activity on and off the platform. And I think it is important to reckon with that and to hold platforms accountable for what they are doing to address hate activity on their platforms. I think it's also important to note that social media can be used by communities that are targeted for hate to push back. But I think that, you know, one of the things the leadership conference that we have been doing is talking about how do you hold these platforms accountable, like Facebook, like Twitter, to make sure that they are sort of living up to their obligation as a company that is often a purveyor of both hate as well as of groups that are trying to combat hate. And so I think there are many ways that we can try to address some of that hate online, and that it is critical to addressing this problem, especially during a pandemic when there's more and more activity online.
What other practical tools do you recommend to bridge divides and fight back against hate crimes and hate mongering? You know, what strategies can people of goodwill adopt?
There are a few different things. So one is I would include people to come to blackjusticesourjustice.org. You can find it. It's more information about our campaign. But there we are continuing to both lift up the work of groups around this country and really around the world that are working to lift up the contributions, for example, of immigrants that are looking to both speak up and condemn hate when they see it. I think there's some really practical things that people can do. So for example, if you're concerned about whether or not where you are living, your jurisdiction is reporting hate crimes, you can join with other groups that are saying, it is important that you report this. It is important to me as somebody who lives in this city. When someone's reporting zero hate crimes, it sends a message. And people have been organizing around the country to make sure that they're making their voices heard to their local law enforcement and to mayors and to others. Online, there are many organizations that are sort of looking how you combat hate online. One of the ways that people are doing that is to both recognize disinformation, don't amplify it if you could avoid that. And that means, you know, information that is purposely trying to sort of to spread misinformation, to spread lies, to spread hate, don't propagate it. But also online, there are many more groups that are working together just to make sure they're fighting back and supporting people who are targeted for hate. So there are many actions that people can take both in their community. One of the most important things I would say is that if people are targeted for hate, figure out how you can support the organizations that where people go to. So whether it's a local LGBT center, a local mosque, a local synagogue, those are the places where people who are targeted for hate, that's where they go, that's who they trust. And so to the extent that people can support those organizations and those entities, that's how you can make sure you're both supporting people who are targeted for hate and listen to them about what they need, both to feel safe and to push back.
Becky Monroe, before we go, one more question to you. Let's just take a quick look at the macro political level. You know, we are in a transition, a political transition to the Biden administration. President-elect Biden has talked about unity, that he wants to try to bring the country together in light of so many divisions. Are you relatively optimistic? How much influence can that type of rhetoric and perhaps subsequent action, what type of influence can that have on depressing this trend of hate crimes and getting more reporting and doing more to combat that? What are you recommending your organization, if you are, to the Biden administration, a larger strategy?
Absolutely. I am optimistic, and honestly, my optimism stems both from this opportunity for change, but also from the communities that we have had the privilege of working with and seeing the ways in which they have pushed back, whether it was through this election to make sure that people were able to vote and had their voices heard, or through the ways that people have come together to support communities that have been targeted for hate. So, for example, we have seen communities come across, whether it's racial justice organizations, religious organizations coming to support, for example, the Asian American community that was seeing an increase in hate. It's also coming from the Black leadership we've seen pushing back against police brutality and people protesting in the streets and really demanding accountability and justice. So I am hopeful. We have submitted our transition recommendations to the Biden administration, and they include both some very specific things around hate crimes data collection, some of the issues we talked about how the Department of Justice right now could improve hate crimes data collection by working with state and local law enforcement agencies. It includes support for legislation like the Jabara Hire No Hate Act. And it also includes really using the bully pulpit. And I do think it matters. As I mentioned, hate is not new and hate is not going to suddenly disappear. But the people who have been fighting hate, the African-American organizations, the other racial justice organizations, the Jewish organizations, Muslim organizations, LGBTQ leaders, the disability rights community, they will make sure that we work together to combat hate, and they will make sure and hold accountable the next administration to make sure they are using their what we call the bully pulpit or just their leadership opportunity. What leaders say matters. We have seen that, and we can see it the other way. We can see it both in the terms of people feeling emboldened to commit acts of hate, but we know that we can also see it in terms of communities coming together to support each other. So I think, you know, when we talk about division, sometimes division is important and is a good force for change in terms of people highlighting, for example, systemic racism. That is important. And the fact that it may divide people, that is something that we as a country need to confront. We need to confront the fact that we still have systemic racism in this country. That kind of division is good. And that kind of division can be productive when people confront our history, confront the truth about ongoing systemic racism, and then use that to really change and move our country forward. So I am optimistic about that. I think that new leadership will help to make sure that we are sort of seizing on that, recognizing that the richness of our country comes from our diversity, comes from immigrants, comes from the extraordinary contributions of Black people, comes from the contributions of Jews and Muslims across this country, from LGBTQ Americans who have made countless sacrifices and contributions, and that we are stronger as a country when we confront the truth about an ongoing history of racism and discrimination, and we use that to bring us closer to our founding ideals.
Becky Monroe is director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Jihadists from the Boko Haram group killed a